This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Now, Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, Truth in Broadcasting.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And Dinesh D'Souza on the line. He's been on our program a few times in the past, most recently about his book, The Enemy at Home, The Cultural Left and Its Responsibility for 9/11. He has a new book out, What's So Great About Christianity? His website, Dinesh D'Souza, DineshDSouza.com, formerly of the Reagan administration and many other interesting iterations in your career. Dinesh, welcome to the program.
Good to be on the show.
Great to have you with us. I've actually spent a fair amount of time with your book here, and first of all, as one author to another and as one Christian to another, I found it interesting and yet oddly polemic. The thing that I find most, that I embrace the most about Christianity is the mystical dimension of it and the core of it I find in Matthew 25. Jesus saying, you know, when the disciples came to him and said, how do we get into heaven? And he said, you know, at the end of days, I'm going to be sitting there in judgment, and those who, you know, fed me when I was hungry will get in. You know, the sheep and the goats, right? Those who fed me when I was hungry, those who clothed me when I was naked, those who visited me when I was in prison, those who healed me when I was sick. And the disciples freak out, and they say, you know, we never saw you hungry, we never saw you sick, we never saw you in prison. We're screwed, because we're not going to get into heaven now. And he said, as you have done to the least of my brethren, you have done unto me. That's the core of what you have spent your entire career attacking in the United States, which is the liberal progressive movement in this democracy.
Well, first of all, I'm not sure you're correctly stating the core, but because remember, we can always bandy Bible passages back and forth. This is part of the problem with you know, you can say this a debate which relies on scripture says this and scripture says that. But I would answer this way. Look, the problem I think with the liberal welfare state is it doesn't rely on compassion or goodness. If the government comes to me and puts a gun to my head and says, listen, you better pay higher taxes, because if you don't, we're going to take your house, or we're going to basically confiscate your account. We're going to forcibly take money from you, which is to say extortion, and then we're going to give it to somebody else who didn't necessarily ask for it and is not necessarily grateful for it. They feel a sense of entitlement. Entitlement is very different than charity. In charity, you feel a sense of moral obligation. There's a sort of fund of goodness that passes between the giver and the receiver. If you were to do something nice for me, I would feel a sense of debt to you and maybe do something nice for somebody else. The whole morality of the transaction, it seems to me, Tom, is stripped out when you introduce the element of government coercion.
So here we get to the core of it then, Dinesh D'Souza, and that is that apparently you believe that the poor among us should rely entirely on the good graces of the wealthy among us and the hopes that they might do well, and that we should turn over to the corporate-ocracy, the corporate powers in this country and the powers of great inherited wealth. Any concern for the general welfare, to quote the Constitution?
No, first of all, I don't believe that, but I think...
Well, that's what you just asserted.
Well, you're shifting cunningly from a religious now to a political issue.
Well, but your book, in the context of being a religious book, is at its core fundamentally a political book. And in fact, you have an entire chapter in it about how, you know, not just America, but Western civilization is based on Christianity, which I would dispute, and Thomas Jefferson would as well. But I'm not shifting craftily here. I mean, this is the essence of your book, sir.
No, the point I'm trying to make here is this, and that is that nowhere do you find, you quoted what you said was the core of Jesus' teaching. Nowhere did Jesus in any way attempt to transform social structures, demand that the Roman government, for example, hand out subsidies to the poor. Jesus was basically talking about interior goodwill, about charity and love in one's heart. So you're making an equation here. If you have love in your heart, you will support the liberal welfare state. Otherwise, you're not a Christian. I'm just saying that's the same kind of hijacking of scripture that you accuse the fundamentalists of.
What I'm saying is that in a democracy, if this were the Soviet Union, I would agree with you. I would absolutely agree with you. If we did not have a representative government that represented we the people, where we collectively make decisions about what we're doing, I would totally agree with you, and you'd be right. But you're wrong. This is a democracy, a small d democracy. This is a representative democratic republic, constitutionally limited in its power, and we the people, through our elected representatives, decide how we are going to treat us and what floor we are going to put under us that we shall not fall through in terms of things like poverty, for example. And that, I think, is fundamentally a Christian value, and it astounds me that you write a book in defense of Christianity and you reject that value.
I don't reject the value. I suppose our disagreement would be over, precisely how to organize this welfare state and where to draw those ceilings. But let me put it this way. We live in one of the richest societies in the world. Even poor people in America would be considered rich by global standards. And so, in a sense, we have nothing in America that would resemble the biblical type of poverty one finds, for example, in the Old Testament or even in the New Testament.
That's a red herring argument. You've got 11 million people in the United States who literally do not know where their next meal is going to come from one day this week.
Well, I mean, my point is I agree with you that we need to take care of the truly disadvantaged. That's not what we're debating here. My book is not about that. My book is an answer to the new atheists who have basically been saying that Christianity is against reason, it's against science, it leads to the kind of fanaticism that we've seen in terrorism and 9/11, it's responsible for much of the war and suffering in the world, the Crusades, the Inquisition. I'm rebutting that argument by showing how short-sighted and shallow it is, and you're trying to draw me into a quite separate argument over whether or not Hillary's health care program is adequate. You know, you see where I'm going?
I don't recall having mentioned Hillary Clinton.
I'm happy to discuss it with you.
Sure.
Don't get me
wrong. No, I understand. And you very craftily have moved it. In Chapter 12, A Designer Planet, Man's Special Place in Creation, you say the latest scientific research shows that we apparently inhabit a world specifically crafted for us. You really believe that of the trillion, 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 trillion planets or celestial bodies out there, that an intelligence specifically created this planet for this particular mammalian vehicle, this particular species, in this particular way at this particular time?
Well, you're refuting an argument that I don't make. I think that it is... I would be foolish if I were to say, out of the billions of planets, we happen to live on one that has life. That's not my point.
Well, let me quote you. The latest scientific research shows that we apparently inhabit a world specifically crafted for us.
Right. The key word here is world. I'm talking about the entire...
I think the key word here is crafted.
Crafted. Let me say what I mean. What I'm saying is that this whole universe, all the planets, including Earth, but every single one, operates according to certain key forces. The gravitational force, the electromagnetic force, the strong nuclear force, the electroweak force. So scientists have said if we change these forces even a tiny little bit, Stephen Hawking discusses it in this in The Brief History of Time. He says if you touch one of those dials.
Yeah, and you quote him in your book, in fact.
And move it, even one part in 100,000 millionth, we'd have no universe, no life. So this is not about us living on a lucky planet out of a lot of planets. It's that the entire universe has to be as big as it is and as old as it is, and all the forces have to be precisely what they are, otherwise we wouldn't be here having this conversation. So that's the correct way to state the
argument. But here we are two Christians arguing about this, but you Catholic, me Protestant, it doesn't require some old guy in a white beard saying, gee, I think I'll organize it this way.
No, but does it seem to suggest an intelligent, designed creator who made it that way? If not,
I don't think so. No, I think it suggests that there is intelligence in the universe. In fact, I believe that the entire universe is intelligence. I think that everything that we're seeing that is.
More likely to believe that inanimate objects are intelligent.
Absolutely.
Inanimate objects are intelligent.
Yes. I believe that everything that we can experience in physical creation is a manifestation of an intelligence that is so vast and transcendent that we can't even comprehend it.
Okay, now you're coming closer to when you say it's a manifestation. Yes, just like an automobile is a manifestation of the intelligence.
No, I mean just like an ice cube floating in water is a manifestation of the water.
It's a manifestation of the water. But
that it's micro to the macro.
Where does the intelligence embodied in the laws of nature come from? That's my question to you.
I think when people like you and I sit down and say, okay, we've got it all figured out, and we're speaking on behalf of that intelligence, and we've got the special line to it, I think that we make fools of ourselves.
I'm not saying we have I'm saying as human beings, we're trying to make sense of our world. And I'm saying when you see intelligence in nature, you presume an intelligent designer. Just as if you and I were to see an automobile, we'd say, look, we may not know how it was put together. We know some smart guy built this. And I'm saying there's enormous intelligence in nature itself. Now, if you're saying you don't know where it came from, that's fine. I'm just saying the best explanation that I can think of is an intelligent designer made it that way. If you've got a better explanation, I'd like to hear it, but we're just trying as fallible human beings in the world to make sense.
Well, I think I just laid it out. Dinesh, can you stick around for a couple minutes?
Of course I can.
Okay, great. I'd like to get into your thoughts on non-Christian religions. And we'll pursue that. We're talking with Dinesh D'Souza, the New York Times bestselling author. His new book, What's So Great About Christianity? 16 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. We're talking to Dinesh D'Souza, his new book, What's So Great About Christianity? Dinesh, if you will indulge me for about 45 seconds, I'd like to play a couple of clips and get your thoughts on them,
sure.
If I may. First of all, Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson.
That I really believe that the pagans and the abortionists and the feminists and the gays and the lesbians who are actively trying to make that an alternative lifestyle, the ACLU, People for the American Way, all of them who tried to secularize America, I point the thing in their face and say, you helped this happen.
9/11.
Well, I totally concur. And the problem is we've adopted that agenda at the highest levels of our government, and so we're responsible to free society for what the top people do.
And that's Pat Robertson. Here's another Falwell.
You got to kill the terrorists before the killing stops. And I'm for the president. Chase them all over the world. If it takes 10 years, blow them all away in the name of the Lord.
And Pat Robertson calling for the assassination of Hugo Chavez.
You know, I don't know about this doctrine of assassination, but if he thinks we're trying to assassinate him, I think we really ought to go ahead and do it. It's a whole lot cheaper than starting a war. And I don't think any oil shipments will stop.
Will you, sir, Dinesh D'Souza, condemn these so-called Christian leaders for these horrifically anti-Christian statements?
Well, of course I'll condemn them. I mean, I'll condemn the statements. I think that those are, first of all, they're clearly political judgments that they're making. Robertson, you know, fancies himself a political commentator. And some people have said, by the way, about Saddam Hussein, it would have been cheaper actually to target Saddam Hussein and assassinate him rather than invade a whole country. So the argument has been made. I wouldn't apply it in the case of Hugo Chavez. So I think that was a very unwise political judgment. And similarly, I think the problem with the Falwell statement, I think, is really this, and that is sort of an attempt to intuit divine will. Sort of God is responsible for AIDS, or God is responsible for punishing some people for 9/11. And I think it's that imputation of theological motives to a God that you say, correctly, we don't know what God's motives are in a given situation. We should be a little bit humble about that.
Yeah. On November 27th, 1095, Pope Urban gave a speech. He said, the noble race of Franks must come to the aid of their fellow Christians in the East. The infidel Turks are advancing. Christians are being oppressed. The Holy Sepulchre is in Muslim hands and has been turned into a mosque. There will be absolution and remission of sins for all who die in the service of Christ. Here they are poor and miserable sinners. There they will be rich and happy. Let none hesitate. They must march next summer. God wills it. Deus vult. God wills it was the marching battle cry. Raymond of Agiles, who was there in 1099 in Jerusalem, wrote, some of our men cut off the heads of their enemies. Others shot them with arrows so that they fell from the towers. Others tortured them longer by casting them into the flames. Piles of heads, hands, and feet were to be seen in the streets of the city. It was necessary to pick one's way over the bodies of men and horses. But these were small matters compared with what happened at the Temple of Solomon, a place where religious services were ordinarily chanted. What happened there? If I tell you the truth, it will exceed your powers of belief. So let it suffice to say this much at least, that in the Temple and Portico of Solomon, we rode in blood up to our knees and bridled. Reigns. This is from a guy who was there. Yet in your book, you claim that only a few thousand people died in the Crusades, and that it's, you know, history has been rewritten.
No, I don't say that. I actually say that if you look at Henry Kamen's great scholarship on the Inquisition, that only 2,000 people died over 300 years, an incident that has been grossly inflated. So the most educated people, if you ask them, would say hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, were killed in the Inquisition, which is complete nonsense.
Well, I'd say hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, were terrorized. I mean, all you have to do is publicly kill a few people. And you terrorize everybody else. I mean, look at the people who got shot, the guy
right,
who got
the,
shot by
the
TSA,
atheists,
and now everybody's a afraid to contradict, you know, to talk back to anybody from the TSA.
But Tom,
it works everywhere.
We're crying crocodile tears over stuff that happened.
Well, here's my question, Dinesh. You condemn other religions, or you have in the past. You know, certainly in your last book you were talking about other religions. You have on this program used the phrase Islamofascism and asserted, as I recall, that you believe that at its core, well, let me let you put it in your own words.
My book has been attacked on the right for being too friendly toward Muslims because I emphasize in The Enemy at Home that there are traditional Muslims and radical Muslims, and we should ally with the traditional Muslims to oppose the radical Muslims.
Isn't the same true of Christianity? Shouldn't you and I be joining forces to condemn Jerry Falwell, you know, may he rest in peace, and Pat Robertson, who's out there with $1 billion and a giant microphone calling himself a Christian?
What kind of sane person equates a Bin Laden or an Ahmadinejad with Pat Robertson? Even when CNN did its commentary, God's Warriors, Christiane Amanpour had to go to the hills of Montana, find a toothless guy in a trailer, and say, here's the Christian equivalent of the Al-Qaeda guys. There's nothing in Christianity today that resembles Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Hezbollah. There's no Christian country run along the lines of the Ayatollah Khomeini's Iran. So this idea
I suspect, Dinesh, that the four and a half million refugees in Iraq right now might not agree with you.
But that's a political decision taken by a country that wasn't doing it on a basis.
I suspect that many of them, particularly since General Boykin is still running around saying our God is bigger than their God, would believe that this was done in the name of Christianity.
Be rational. Don't you think our presence in Iraq has a lot more to do with oil and American interests and stability than it has to do with Christianity?
I suspect so, but I don't think that that's how it's perceived by many Muslims. No, I agree with you, but that's not how it's perceived by many Muslims.
Well, that's a problem.
So we need to disavow the radicals among us, among our Christians as well.
I would disavow them, but there's no sane equation between the Christian radicals and the so-called Islamic radicals. That's the bogus equation you're making.
Tim McVeigh, Christian radical.
Well, agreed, but look how marginal he is in Christianity.
Okay.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
So now we're a nation at permanent war. I can't help but wonder just what it's all for. Are we killing for freedom, or is freedom what's died? We should know the answer if God's on our side.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. You know, last week I spent, what, 8, 9, 10 days, something like that, I forget, continuously on the road. And I have an iPod that I have loaded a whole bunch of old music that I just love into, you know, old Tim Buckley stuff and things, and Richard and Mimi Farina and things, singers you've probably never even heard of, but in any case, which I just love listening to when I'm flying, you know, it just takes me away. But United Airlines has put Christmas music, and it's actually mostly old and sacred Christmas music on Channel 5 on their in-flight system. And even though their in-flight system sucks, in as much as it comes through with a hum in the background and a hiss over the top of it, and it's either the volume control is either too loud or too soft, I found myself in the last four or five flights, a couple of them running several hours, deciding to listen to their in-flight music rather than what I had on my iPod, just because the music made me feel so good, frankly. I mean, it's an anchor to my childhood, whatever. I am mourning the loss of loving, compassionate, not just Christianity, but religion in general, but in particular Christianity in this country. I'm mourning the loss of it. I'm mourning the loss of the idea that religion should be for the religious, as it were, rather than for the government. That government should be for we the people rather than for the institutions of religion. This is not, by the way, something new. Thomas Jefferson took this on at some length. You know, this famous quote from him that is used so very often by people to say, oh, the founders were these Bible-thumping, God-fearing guys who wanted America to be a religious nation. And, in fact, some of them were. I mean, Patrick Henry, for example, wanted a theocracy. But most of them, the vast majority of them, did not. And the famous quote from Jefferson, which is carved in the Jefferson Memorial, where he says, "Where I've sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of men," is used by people to say, "See, Jefferson, you know, he thought that religion was America and we were founded on Christian values and all this." Here's the entire letter from which that quote comes. It was sent to his good friend Benjamin Rush, who was a Unitarian. Unitarians are not even sure if there is a God, right? And Ben Rush was you know, a firm Unitarian. He's a physician. And this was 2 months before the election of 1800. So Jefferson was saying, "Please don't share this with anybody." It came out after the election. He said, "Dear sir, I promised you a letter on Christianity, which I have not forgotten. I do not know that it would reconcile the genus irritable vetum," this is Latin for the angry priests, "who are all in arms against me. Their hostility is on too interesting a ground to be softened." And by the way, he wasn't talking about Catholic priests. He was talking about the Anglicans and the Presbyterians, principally. "The delusion on the clause of the Constitution," here he's talking about the First Amendment, "which, while it secured the freedom of press, covered also the freedom of religion, has given the clergy a very favorite hope of obtaining an establishment of a particular form of Christianity throughout the United States. And as every sect believes its own form is the one true one, every one hopes for his own, but especially the Episcopalians and the Congregationalists. The returning good sense of our country," now here he's talking about him beating John Adams in the election of 1800, which he's anticipating 2 months in advance or hoping for, "the returning good sense of our country threatens abortion to their hopes. And they," the preachers, "believe that any portion of power confided to me, such as being elected president, will be exerted in opposition to their schemes. And they believe rightly, for I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man. But this is all they have to fear from me, but in their minds enough too." In other words, this quote that everybody is using from Jefferson to say, "Oh yeah, look at, he thinks a religion should be part of government," was his saying, "I'm going to fight religion in government." This was the big debate that Jefferson and Madison had. Jefferson was afraid of essentially religious folks like Mike Huckabee, you know, ministers becoming politicians. He was afraid it would corrupt government. Madison, his protege, Jefferson's protege, would write back and say, "Oh, that's never going to happen. The American people would never be so crazy as to elect a, you know, somebody who is primarily guided by religion in their political philosophy. What we have to fear is that the government might start giving money to churches and thus corrupt Christianity." Now, Madison was a Christian. Jefferson was a deist. So, you know, Madison was worried about his religion being corrupted. Then there was the argument that, well, no, this is this nation was founded on Christianity because British common law came from Christianity. Actually, only two of the Ten Commandments are in our law. And so here Jefferson, on February 10th, 1814, a letter to Thomas Cooper, he says, "Finally, in answer to the question why the Ten Commandments are not part of the common law of England, we must say it's because they never were. Anybody asserting the Ten Commandments are the basis of American or British law is manifestly believing a document that is a manifest forgery." He said, "Christianity was not introduced until the 7th century in England, the conversion of the first Christian king of the Heptarchy having taken place around the year 598, the last about 686. Here, then, was a space of 200 years during which the common law was in existence and Christianity was no part of it. In truth, the alliance between church and state in England has ever made their judges accomplices in the frauds of the clergy, and even bolder than that they are." And, you know, I could go on with a dozen other quotes, but that's the point. I mean, it's just, I'm mourning the loss of a spiritual Christianity that seems increasingly to be taken over by a political Christianity and a political discourse that is grounded in the finest principles of Christianity, Judaism, and frankly every other religion in the world, rather than the basest principles, which certainly are to be found in every religion just as well. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Paul in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Paul.
Hey, good morning, Tom. How you doing?
I'm well, but I'll get better.
Good.
What's up?
All right, me too. Say, I was a Christian most of my life, and but there was always a part of me that would question all religions, and I finally decided that religion really is just a cause for most misery, for a lot of misery in the world. And so a year ago I joined the Freedom From Religion Foundation, and I put a challenge out to you to be a member of their organization, just to get a different perspective on things.
I'm familiar with their work. I'm familiar with their website. I mean, you know, they advertised on our show for a while, or on our network,
yeah,
rather.
And
you know, I absolutely have no problem with somebody being an atheist, which I believe is a religion, or an agnostic, which I don't think is a religion. You know, an atheist says they have certainty that there's no God. I can't say that there definitely is a God or that there isn't a God, and I don't think that an atheist can either. And I think the agnostics, at least, are honest about it. They say, I don't have any idea, you know, and I agree with the idea of freedom from religion, at least in the context of the state. But, you know, that's as far as I'm going to take it. But, Paul, I appreciate, you know, your comment and your thoughts. George in Phoenix. Hey, George.
Hey, good morning, Tom, and amen for your thoughts this morning. Your guest, though, seemed to have selective amnesia because he kept saying that this current administration and their actions in the Middle East were political. Yet, if I remember my history correctly, this guy went to every major congregational, evangelistic congregational church in this country while his papa was still in the White House to try and gain a foothold in the political spectrum, and then when he ran, those were the folks that supported him.
Right. He was in charge of bringing the Christian vote in for his father when his father ran against Bill Clinton.
Correct.
Right.
And as I used to say, they were pushing an Armageddon theology.
Yep.
That was...
And still are.
And still are, exactly. So for your guest to you know, talk about crocodile tears and how uneducated folks that do know a little bit about the Inquisition and do know a lot about the Crusades and the horrendous behavior of the French and English in the Middle East, it's kind of disingenuous.
Yeah, okay. Good point, George. Thank you. Jim in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Jim.
Yeah, Tom. I love that your explanation about that quote from Thomas Jefferson. It fits right in just what I was saying, going to say. I see conservatives so often taking things out of context to make their arguments. For example, your guest, he quoted from Stephen Hawking's Brief History of Time, but there's actually, he took it out of context again. There is a statement in here where Hawking specifically says that he doesn't think there is any God.
No, I know that. And Dinesh D'Souza says that in his book. Now, he presents both, or arguably presents, but he'll present, you know, an atheistic argument, and then he'll refute it. And one of the atheistic arguments that he's refuting, he actually says that Hawking's internal logic is inconsistent, and he quotes Hawking in two different places to do that.
Yeah. Well, and also I noticed he did it again when he was saying that this was not a theological war, and he quotes that TV show that had to find somebody out in Montana or something. But there's plenty of famous people in the Republican administration that have made it clear that there are at least some people that very much think that this is a religious war.
Yeah, no, absolutely, Jim. And then look at what's going on with the U.S. Air Force Academy, you know, turning it into a bastion of radical Christianity. It's dangerous. 45 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Thomas Jefferson, June 5th, 1824, letter to Major John Cartwright. Arguably an animist statement. He said, "Our revolution commenced on more favorable ground than the foundation of English or biblical law. It presented us an album on which we were free to write what we pleased. We had no occasion to search into musty records, to hunt up royal parchments, or to investigate the laws and institutions of a semi-barbarous ancestry. We appealed to those of nature and found them engraved on our hearts." 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Charles in San Leandro, California. Hey, Charles.
Yeah, I wanted to clarify. Unitarians really reject the Trinity. They reject the Father, Son, Holy Ghost bundle.
Right.
And that's really based on the fact that Calvin had Michael Servetus burned at the stake in 1533. So it was really, you know...
Was that the beginning of Unitarianism?
Yeah, the reaction... Calvin was perceived as such an evil and despicable person that whatever doctrine he taught was thought to be a false doctrine. And so literally, Unitarianism was born on the ashes of Michael Servetus.
That's very interesting. I didn't realize that. I've spoken to many Unitarian churches, and we've attended a few over the years, but I've never sat down with a Unitarian and said, "Tell me the history and origin of your theology or lack thereof."
Yeah, it's actually not mine. I'm a Buddhist, but a good friend of mine is a Unitarian minister.
Yeah.
And in fact, the Unitarians are also being drummed out of the Air Force Academy.
Yeah, I know. I love the old joke about, you know, the Unitarian comes to a fork in the road, and one sign in one direction says to heaven, and the other direction says to a discussion about heaven, and he takes the road to the discussion. Anyhow, Charles, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Bonnie in Burkittstown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bonnie.
Hi. We have a lot of jokes about UUs. I'm a UU myself.
Mm-hmm.
I congratulate you for putting up with the Sousa's shrillness and incessant projection in his everything is an offense or defense approach. I, too, believe that the entire universe, from the most infinitesimal particle to the entire vastness of the universe, is intelligent. And de Sousa implied that that was illogical. The only major difference, I think, between revealed faith believers, latecomers in human history and prehistory, is that they anthropomorphize this intelligence and set it outside the universe, whereas universalists with a small u, or animists, the difference is that they say that God is the universe itself, and that is incessantly revealing itself to us, and it's in us because we're a part of it.
And I would submit to you, Bonnie, that when you read, as I have, you read Dark Night of the Soul by St. John of the Cross, read Interior Castle by St. Teresa of Avila. She was the Carmelite nun who reformed the Carmelite order. St. John was helping her. In fact, that's why he was imprisoned back during the Spanish Inquisition. Read The Little Flowers of St. Francis, the writings of St. Francis. Read Thomas Merton, as I've read at least five of his books. I spent a week with Wayne Teasdale, Brother Wayne Teasdale, Catholic priest. He just died a year or so ago, a dear friend of mine and Louise's, who wrote The Mystic Heart, a brilliant, brilliant book on Catholicism and Christianity. Wayne spent half his year at the Catholic Theological Seminary in Chicago teaching priests how to become priests, and spent the other half of his year walking around India in with a begging bowl, living in absolute poverty 6 months out of every year. We sat with the Dalai Lama and talked about Christianity for days. I mean, this concept, what you're talking about, what I'm talking about, I think is let's make it larger. Let's understand it in the grandest and most extraordinary and mystical sense, rather than trying to make it smaller and say, oh well, here's a rule book that just follow the rule, and it's not just the rule book. Bonnie, thank you for the call. Forgive my rant. I guess that's what I'm supposed to do. That's my job. Boz in Phoenix. Hey, Boz.
Hi, Tom. Long-time listener, first-time caller. I just want to say I came to this country back in 1999 from Bosnia and Herzegovina, and I used to be a Muslim. I kind of gave up my faith not long ago, many other reasons. But I want to say that this the fact that is that this country was brought up on Christianity, and that many politicians believe that, and that's why every other religion has been being put down, and it will continue until we get some officials in a government that understand that the true meaning of the Constitution and what the forefathers were trying to make this country as the greatest nation of the free people. And that's being brought down through the years. It's only getting worse, and I want to see what is your opinion about it.
I absolutely agree with you, and I think a good example is this viral email that's running around, particularly in Republican circles. I've had several Republicans forward it to me. It's Gary Trudeau in Doonesbury has been talking about it for 3 days now. suggesting that Barack Obama is Muslim. As if that's, first of all, it's not the case, but, you know, his middle name is Hussein, and he went to this madrasa in Indonesia or whatever. You know, I mean, it just lays all this out, like, oh my God, he's a Muslim. Like, that should be an indictment against him. I mean, you know, this is just so wrong to use religion like this to tear people apart. And on top of that, to lie about it. Boz, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Gary in Long Island. Hey, Gary, got about a minute before we've got to wrap up this hour. What's up?
Okay, Tom, I'll make it quick. If you look at Blackwater and the rise of Eric Prince, okay, he is a classic example of how you could equate a Christian Al-Qaeda type organization. He started Blackwater about 10 years ago. It was a shooting range, basically. He had no business experience besides his...
Yeah, but this is, Blackwater is not Al-Qaeda. Blackwater is a business that has benefited as a result of crony capitalism.
Yeah, but give it time. He would have never got those contracts worth in the billions if he wasn't a Christian, a radical Christian. He's a board member of the Christian Freedom...
Sure, it's an old boy club. No, I understand. There's an old boy club of hard right-wing so-called Christians.
Only the Muslim religion is open to a radical militant wing being fed by, you know, people that will give it money and let them do what they want to do.
No, I agree with you, Gary, that there is a rise now of radical right-wing militant Christianity in the United States. And frankly, I think it's not just a threat to this country and to peace around the world. It's a threat to Christianity itself. That's what concerns me the most. I'm back there with James Madison saying, hey, wait a minute, let's try to preserve the integrity of religion by keeping our political institutions out of it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Welcome to the Democracy Zone.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Catherine Newman on the line with us. She's the Dean of Social Science at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study, the Malcolm Wiener Professor of Urban Studies at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, and the author of a new article in The Nation magazine. You can find it at thenation.com, thenation.com, titled John Edwards, Like FDR, He's the Real Deal. Catherine, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
The real deal?
I think so.
Why?
Because he's the most progressive candidate running. He's the one with the most...
More so than Dennis Kucinich?
He's the most progressive candidate who actually has a shot, I should say. He has the most detailed plan for what we should do with the minimum wage, union organizing, rules, access to college, early childhood education, housing, fair trade agreements, the lot. For my money, there just isn't anybody better who's running that has a real shot at the White House. And I think he should be supported by people who genuinely care about this agenda.
Yeah, I agree with you. That's why six times now I've gone to his website and given him money.
Good for you.
And I'm curious about your take on why... I mean, for example, John Edwards is still, I believe, his position is still that he's in favor of the death penalty, which I oppose, Dennis Kucinich opposes. I mean, there are a few areas where some perhaps just bowing to political reality, you know, gay marriage, for example, he's now softening his position, or moderate, whatever, you know, talking about how he's personally conflicted about it. And his wife has just kind of come right out and said, you know, this is something that she supports. But why do you say that Kucinich is not electable? Why do you think he's not one of the top candidates when Edwards is?
I just think Kucinich doesn't have the traction, and I don't really have an explanation for why. I'm not a political scientist or a specialist in these matters. I think he appears to be a little bit too flighty to people who observe him, but that's a pretty off-the-cuff theme, and it could be just as much geography as anything else, or the fact that he's been at it pretty often and it hasn't gained traction. So
yeah.
It's really hard for me to say.
Well, and John Edwards ran for vice president last time, and those of us who think the Ohio election was stolen actually won. We're talking with Catherine Newman. She has a new article in The Nation, thenation.com. You can read it or pick up a copy of The Nation at your local bookstore about John Edwards. Have we had a candidate as progressive as FDR since FDR?
Well, you know, I think if the war in Vietnam had not interfered as mightily as it did, that actually Lyndon Johnson would be remembered as one of the most important presidents in the 20th century with respect to the rights and options for the poor. But unfortunately for him and for the country and for the world, the war in Vietnam was very real. He was committed to it. It dragged his presidency down, I think to his own regret, because his domestic policy, both in terms of policy and his magnificent speeches on domestic policy, really could move you to tears today. There aren't many people who have given speeches that were so solidly on the side of the poor as Lyndon Johnson's. But yeah. Beyond that, no, I can't honestly think of anybody. I really can't.
Yeah, in fact, Lyndon Johnson cut poverty in half in the United States in just 4
years.
Well,
you know, the war on poverty, for all the flack that it's received, actually made a very big difference. And where it fell short, it was mainly because it wasn't fully implemented, not that it couldn't have done more if it had been. So
yeah.
I think Edwards's policies are very much in line with the war on poverty and all the positive things that it achieved.
Here's, you know, it's interesting that you bring up Lyndon Johnson, Catherine Newman, because here's a guy, I mean, I remember back when he was president as a teenager and the war was going on, reading a book called A Texan Looks at Lyndon, which was a very, very, I forget the author now, but it was very widely read in right-wing circles. And also among those of us in the anti-war movement book, because it basically laid out the crimes of Lyndon Johnson when he was a politician in Texas and when he was Speaker of the House. I mean, here's a guy who was never elected as a progressive, who
right.
never campaigned as a progressive.
Right.
He was elected and put into office and held power, frankly, by controlling a block of racists and, you know,
Southern
racists.
Look at what he did with it. It's
no, I understand.
Quite
no,
remarkable.
Well, this is the point that I'm trying to make, and this is the question that I have for you, is Lyndon Johnson came into office as not even a moderate. I mean, he came into office as a right-wing cracker from the South, and yet he became one of our most progressive presidents. Don't you think it's possible, and similarly, Franklin Roosevelt in 1932, his election was not about being the New Deal. I mean, the New Deal came after he became president. Teddy Roosevelt ran as the white power, not white power, but the white guy representing corporate interests, you know, as the Vice President of McKinley. Don't you think it's possible that regardless of who is elected, whether assuming that the Democrat actually wins the national election, whether it's Obama, whether it's Edwards, whether it's Hillary Clinton, whether it's Dennis Kucinich or Chris Dodd or Joe Biden or anybody, Bill Richardson, that the pressure of the public is such, that the time is such, that the times create the politician, and that the next president, assuming that president is a Democrat, may be the next FDR regardless of how they go into the election?
Well, you know, I hope you're right, because that would make us all rest a little easier. but it worries me, because I think that sometimes the tendencies of the candidates really do matter, and that the times don't dictate everything. Actually, you know, the times can set up a certain fork in the road about which way we go, and we can get welfare reform when that's not what we elected the person to do, or we can get
right.
a Congress that can't seem to pull us out of this war, even with an overwhelming mandate, both electoral and public opinion mandate, to do so. So, you know, I would like to think you're right, but I just don't know, and I think the safest bet, when any of us is exercising the franchise anyway, is to go with the candidate who is closest to your sense of the direction the country should move in. And for me, that's John Edwards. Now, does that mean that Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama might not end up being like that? Maybe they would, but, you know, why take a chance? I'd rather vote for the person who's right now standing for the things I believe in.
And a comment that you made kind of in passing about, ending poverty as we know it, the exact phrase, but you made reference to Bill Clinton slashing the anti-welfare programs, ending welfare as we know it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a relatively famous and I don't think apocryphal story of how Bill Clinton campaigned as a progressive. I remember the election of 1992. I mean, he was campaigning as a progressive. And a couple of weeks before he was inaugurated, Robert Rubin and Alan Greenspan sat him down and said, okay, Bill, you ran as a progressive. Now we're going to tell you the facts of life.
Mm-hmm.
And he then governed frankly, to the right of Eisenhower. He governed in a way that was more conservative than Dwight Eisenhower.
Well, you know, I think that when the history of the Clinton administration is written, it will undoubtedly matter to everyone that Congress soon thereafter, you know, tipped in the wrong direction. And so I don't even know. I mean, he's not my...
No, but I mean, my question here is, let's say John Edwards gets elected president on a progressive platform, just like Bill Clinton did.
Well,
what's to prevent him from ending up being a so-called moderate, really
I guess there's nothing absolutely to prevent it, but I think if you add together the platform he set out and has campaigned on, when, you know, I don't think anybody in their right mind would be certain that you could win an election on poverty. You do that if you're really committed to it, because it's actually a political risk, I think, to do that. So I think that his convictions are very clear, because it's not a great political calculation to do it, one. And two, I think you can trust those sentiments and instincts, especially because they're hopefully going to be accompanied by an overwhelming majority in Congress. And that really helps. I mean, I don't know what Bill Clinton's, deepest convictions were, independent of the realpolitik he faced with a Republican-controlled Congress. Who knows what he would have come out like policy-wise if that had not been the case. But with this election, we can at least hope, and I think be reasonably confident, there's going to be a commanding majority in both houses. And that is a unique, historic opportunity. It probably won't come along again in my lifetime. And I would like to see someone elected who's going to run with that mandate and put the country on a new deal course, so that we can correct all the horrendous right-wing directions we've launched in the last 12 years or so. So it's the combination of this historic occasion of having this potential mandate and the instincts and platforms and honest promises of the candidates that I think can give you somewhat more confidence.
Right, and in your opinion, and you're not part of the Edwards campaign,
no.
John Edwards is the guy.
I'm a supporter, but I'm not part of his campaign. Right.
Catherine Newman, Dean of Social Science at Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study, Professor of Urban Studies at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. Her article in The Nation, right now, it's out now, thenation.com. John Edwards, like FDR, he's the real deal. Catherine, thanks so much.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Just a quick reminder, November 29th, I'll be in Los Angeles, California, at 7:30 p.m. Barnes & Noble in Santa Monica. I'm doing a riff on Cracking the Code, my new book, plus a book signing thereafter. And on November 30th in Oak Park, California, the Ventura County Democrats Speaker Series, I'll be speaking from 7 to 9 p.m. And we'll have, hopefully soon, we'll have information about that up on our website. Got to get around to that. We'll get our website updated in the next day or two so that you can find that information. I'm sorry it's not there yet, but it will be. And on December 14th, we'll be in Minneapolis, Minnesota, 7 p.m., University of Minnesota Bookstore, Kauffman Memorial Union. I find this quite interesting. 30% in Iowa support Obama. This is the latest poll, ABC News poll, and Chris Matthews apparently has become a sportscaster. With funny music, his show, entirely horse race. I was astounded yesterday. I watched it for an hour and heard, as I recall, no mention of issues whatsoever. Only who's ahead and why and how is that perceived and is this about change or not and, you know, la-di-da-da-da. And I think that, you know, Catherine's point that we need to be paying attention to the issues and the issues that these candidates are representing is a really critical one, and it's one that the media really doesn't want to go to, because many of the issues are issues that on the Democratic side have to do with reducing the wealth and power of the very corporations that are providing us with our so-called news. We'll pick up that theme with Howard Kurtz in the next hour, but for right now, this poll, this the new ABC poll, Obama 30%, Clinton 26%, Edwards 22%, all of these, 11% for Bill Richardson, all of these within the sample tolerances, within the margin of error, 3 or 4%, it's still relatively speaking a dead heat, but it looks like Obama is pulling out ahead. But here's the question. Does this mean 30%? That means that fewer, what that means is 70% of the people are saying no, not Obama. That 74% of the people are saying no, not Clinton. Excuse me, 84%. And that 88% of the people are saying no, not Edwards. So here's the question. If one of these three candidates were to drop out of the race, what would happen to the other two? If Edwards, for example, were to drop out, would Obama go from, would he pick up all 22%? Would he go from 30 to 52% against 26% for Clinton? Or would Clinton pick up most of his vote? If Clinton were to drop out of the race, how would it shake out between Obama and Edwards? If Obama were to drop out of the race, how would it shake out between Clinton and Edwards? I haven't seen, frankly, any polls that ask that question. And I think that what that would do, if anybody were to bother to ask that question, is it would tell us to what extent people are voting really for, hey, this is the person, or are they voting for change or not change? For example, more than half of the people who voted said they're more interested in change than they are in experience. Which I think is code for, experience is code for Clinton, and change is code for Edwards and Obama, I'm guessing. And Richardson, for that matter. I mean, Edwards is not in office right now. He's clearly an outsider. Obama is in office, but, you know, relative newbie to federal politics. Clinton's been around for a long time. You know, she wasn't elected to the presidency, but she's essentially running on having been first lady as well as being the senator, two-term senator from New York. So does that mean that what's really going on is that 74% of the people are saying, no, we don't want Hillary Clinton? And among that 74%, some are saying, well, you know, if I have to pick somebody other than Clinton, I'll take Obama. And some of them are saying, I'll take Edwards. Some are saying, I'll take Bill Richardson. I don't know. But my sense is that there's something like that going on. And it would be fascinating to see some polls that actually engage the issues. Where are you at on the issues? So, anyhow, 1-866-303-2270. Sean in San Francisco. Hey, Sean.
Hello.
Hey. Yeah, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Well, I'd like to see a progressive candidate elected, but I think that the question of issues only comes up with the public during crisis times. I don't believe that people perceive that we're in a crisis now. I think that people are in a state of denial, that they like candidates which support their denial. They want to feel good. People are motivated by their instincts, and right now they don't feel like their material instincts are threatened. They feel like they want to feel good about
themselves. I strongly disagree, Sean. I think that the middle class in America is terrified. People are losing their health insurance left and right. People have no job security anymore. To the extent that they have jobs, they're not the good jobs that we used to have. They're concerned about terrorism. They're concerned about, and not just, you know, a bomb going off in their city. They're concerned about the possibility that we might be nuking Iran. I mean, I think people are very concerned and they're very engaged. I don't think that the media is talking about the issues because the media wants to treat this like a horse race.
Well, I do agree with you, but I think that, you know, the media is motivated by trying to attract the attention of the public. And I think that what we're talking about is the attention being focused on issues that, you know, like emotional issues, like we're talking about abortion,
gay marriage, and abortion, things like that. Yeah, that's where the Republicans put their focus. But I would tell, I would take it a step farther, Sean, and say the one thing that the media is interested in focusing on is drawing eyeballs to their TV shows so that they can sell more advertising. I mean, that's what they're about, and that's why it's infotainment.
It just don't get any better than this. That's about if there's anything better, it's something I missed. It just don't get any better than this.
Making a better America, minute by minute. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. Strange stuff going on out there.
But maybe I'm crazy.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe you're crazy.
Possibly. Maybe Fran Townsend is. being interviewed on CNN.
Let me ask you this question, first of all. You're leaving with concerns about what might happen here next year. The terrorists could possibly target the U.S. elections. What do you know that we should be worried about?
Well, it's not that we know that there's a specific threat, John. What we do know is we saw the Madrid train bombings just before the elections in Spain. After Gordon Brown took office, we saw the bombings at Glasgow. So we know that Al-Qaeda views these periods as being a particularly vulnerable period. We don't have any specific...
Yeah. Be afraid. Be very afraid. There's an election coming after all. Yeah. 1-866-303-2276. Expect to hear more of this, by the way. That's Frances Townsend, the woman who wrote the love letter to George Bush on her way out, the national security advisor, the woman who has had the job that Condi Rice had leading up to 9/11 when she totally dropped the ball and failed to prepare in any way or respond to any of the many alerts that were coming into this country from other countries and from our intelligence service that 9/11 was going to happen. Oh, gee, let's just have a picnic. Let's just go down to Crawford and have the longest presidential vacation in the history of the United States presidency. And after that, George was still afraid to go back to Washington, D.C. He went to Florida, where his brother put the entire state on a high state of alert. And on it goes anyway. 1-866-303-2270. We've talked about an awful lot here today. A lot on the board. Len in New York City. Hey, Len, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. It was nice to meet you last week.
Thank you, Len.
And I always find your conversation interesting. And I think the question you asked was backwards. The first question would be, in my mind, if all the candidates other than Barack Obama and Edwards dropped out, where would all of that support draw to? And, you know, I don't think that any one of them would have more than 40% in a three-way. But I believe that Hillary wouldn't have more than 45% in any two-way, except for perhaps against Kucinich and Gravel and maybe Dodd.
Yeah, so that's my guess, too, is that virtually all of the non-Hillary candidates are the, quote, change candidates, and Hillary is perceived as the, quote, steady, stable establishment candidate, you know, end quote. I'm using phrases that I hear in the mainstream media. I personally am uncomfortable with them, but I don't have an alternative right off the top of my head. I think you're right. That's how it would slice down. That's how it would break out. That's an interesting point. Thanks a lot, Len. I appreciate it. Mark in San Francisco. Hey, Mark.
Hey, great to talk to you. I have a concern. I think all of the candidates are currently part of a bad trend in our country toward corporatism or what might be termed neo-fascism. What is your opinion on the sovereignty of the United States versus the North American Union? I know there is some discussion of the establishment of a North American Union. I wonder where you come down in that.
Well, I'm opposed to it. But the North American Union ain't nothing compared to the World Trade Organization. I mean, the conservatives for years and years, I mean, literally since Woodrow Wilson tried to get us into the League of Nations unsuccessfully, and certainly since I believe it was Truman, it might have been, yeah, it had to have been Truman got us into the United Nations. Conservatives have fought against our being part of the United Nations because our Constitution says that if we sign treaties, those become the law of the land. So in other words, we can sign a treaty with France or with any country in the world, you know, Canada.
I understand.
And that becomes the law that you and I have to live under. This transfer of sovereignty, which occurred by signing the treaties that created the United Nations, did surrender some of our sovereignty with regard to our ability to unilaterally declare war, for example. But I would say that the World Trade Organization, NAFTA, GATT, all these so-called free trade deals, these are all treaties that are surrendering our economic sovereignty, which arguably is even more important than our ability to unilaterally declare war, because it ultimately means, you know, who ends up owning America. And,
I understand, but given that context, at what point does the right to bear arms and the necessity for a, shall we say, armed correction become necessary?
It ain't ever going to happen, Mark. Do you really think that with a 22 rifle you're going to take on the U.S. Army?
No, well, my attitude is at the point that they go to a North American Union, there is no America. At what point am I going to stand amidst the Founding Fathers and give my life in the pursuit of liberty?
You do that by showing up at a political party meeting. You do that by taking over the Democratic and Republican parties. You do that by becoming an activist in the Green Party. You do,
I agree.
It is no longer possible to do that, and it hasn't been possible for over 100 years to do that with guns.
Let me follow up. All right, we have a voting system that is corrupted by machines at this point, and the sanctity of our voting apparatus is in deep question. At a certain point, yes, you have to work within every element of the system that we have. But there's a tipping point, Tom, and I think we're very close. And I'm asking Americans, at what point does it become necessary?
Yeah, it may be necessary. It's not possible, Mark. That's my point. You're not
give
going
me
to
liberty
take on
or the... give me death, Tom. It's not a fantasy. That's what it may take.
Yeah, you're operating on the assumption, Mark, that the Second Amendment is there because the founders thought that someday the patriots may need to rise up against an oppressive government. And if
all right,
that
let's
was,
take a different
and
time.
If that was
John,
the case, let me finish my sentence here, Mark. If that was the case, then the founders would have said the right of citizens to bear any military armament shall not be abridged. The right to own a cannon, the right to own a battleship. And that's not what it says. The Second Amendment came about as a result of a compromise in a debate between people like Jefferson, who felt that during times of peace we should have no army whatsoever because it had the potential to have a military coup and overthrow the government, and people like John Adams, who felt like we should always have an army because there were external threats like France, or in the case of the War of 1812, England and Canada. And so the compromise was that local militias would be created, and that those local militias would you could ring the church bells, and everybody between the ages of 17 and 47, to quote Thomas Jefferson, would grab their rifle out of their closet and step out in front of their house and be part of the national army. And that, I mean, you know, the way it is in Switzerland right now, the way it is actually in several countries. And that's why the Second Amendment's there. It's the remaining fragment of a constitutional amendment that said there shall be no standing army in time of peace. There shall only be local militias. And in order to maintain a well-regulated militia, the right of citizens to bear arms shall not be abridged. It had nothing to do with overthrowing a government.
And I can see the point. And I was raised a pacifist, so I'm willing to concede that point. But what other form of redress do we have if we've been hijacked? I mean, literally,
seize control of the political system. Mark, if you or I were to say, okay, we've got all our media is in the hands of a couple small companies. Let's try and take over GE. Let's try and take over Disney. You know, GE owns MSNBC and NBC. Disney owns ABC. Let's try and take over one of these giant corporations so we can change the political discourse. Ain't going to happen. We'd have to raise billions, hundreds of billions of dollars. Impossible. But this is the solution. Here you've got a machine, a giant multi-million dollar, 200-year-old machine that arguably has more power than any corporation in America if it only chose to use it, the Democratic Party, and they are sitting there saying, please come in and take us over.
We need to
be infiltrating and taking over the Democratic Party the way that the right wing wackos infiltrated and took over the Democratic Party.
I agree. I think that
the Republican Party.
Our representatives have been hijacked. There is no responsiveness to the we the people. So
right. So you do it not by stocking guns like David Koresh. You do it by showing up at the party meetings, you and 20 friends, and getting yourself elected.
I've already conceded that point to you. Granted, violence is not the answer. However, I would like you to agree that we are at a point where extreme measures, advanced measures of organizing must be taken. And literally, the parties have been hijacked by foreign powers. And
I agree with you that we are at a... by and large, I'm agreeing with you. What I'm saying is, you know, I've been there and done that. I mean, I was in SDS back in the day, and I have friends who went to jail. And it's just, you know, violence didn't work then. It won't work now. Now, the process has to be, and this is, frankly, a far more radical thing than saying just show up and vote or support the Democratic candidate. The process has to be that we're going to go way beyond that, far more subversive. We're going to take over a political party.
That's why I mentioned this, because I think it's important for people to go through the logic. And that leaves us with what? Citizen governance. People have to take more responsibility for their part in this process.
That's absolutely right. And getting out there and getting active. It's not enough just to vote. It's not enough just to write a letter to the editor. You have to show up. Mark, thank you for the call. Monica in Novato, California. We have about a half a minute before we got to take a break.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I've been home on disability for a year and a half, and I feel like I've gotten a private education in history and government from you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My comment is just about your question. as to which way the vote would go in case one of the top three Democratic candidates would drop out of the race. And I wondered if you might comment a little about instant runoff voting.
That's the solution. I mean, you know, that is very much the solution to so much of this. If we had IRV in our primaries, if we had instant runoff voting nationally, and you know who's working really aggressively for this and has gotten it passed in over 300 communities in the United States, the largest being San Francisco, is the Green Party. And that's one of the reasons that I encourage people to show up at Green Party meetings as well and participate and get the Green Party, because the Democrats and the Republicans will never, never, never go for instant runoff voting because they don't want to surrender their power. So we need to be active on multiple fronts here. 45 minutes past the hour. Thank you, Frank, for the call.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour. Ellen Ratner on the line with us at the Talk Radio News Service from Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Ellen, I'm seeing here that Scotty McClellan has finally published it's coming out in April, actually, but leaking. And he's saying that George Bush himself was implicated in the what his father referred to as treason of outing Valerie Plame and lied to Scotty McClellan about it.
Well, what he's saying is that he was not told the truth by members of the White House. And that included the whole team.
Right. Here's the exact quote from him. He's talking about the most powerful leader in the world had called upon me to speak on his behalf and help restore credibility he lost amid the failure to find weapons. So I stood at the White House briefing podium in front of it goes on, blah, 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 blah. There was one problem. It was not true. I had unknowingly passed along false information, and five of the highest ranking officials in the administration were involved in my doing so. Rove, Libby, the vice president, the president's chief of staff, and the president himself. End of quote. That sounds to me like a criminal indictment.
Well, let's put it this way. I know Scott McClellan very well. The nicest human being on the planet. Too nice of a guy. And a guy who, in my view, was never ready for the rough and ready politics of the White House or any administration like that. And I think the guy was in shock, frankly.
Yeah, well, it sounds like he's rather angry about being lied to by George Bush.
Wouldn't you if your entire credibility
but
is on the line?
But by doing this, I mean, you know, he lives in Texas. He's taking on basically, you know, the Bush, Mike Beloy refers to it as a Bush crime family. I think, you know, there is a Bush mafia out there. I mean,
and obviously McClellan has decided that he's not going to get anything from these guys anyway, and he would rather leave with his reputation. And that's exactly what he's doing. And it's going to be really interesting, and it's going to be very interesting to see who at the White House press corps, who he's known for years, he decides to give those interviews to. Are you there? Yeah. Hello?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me, Ellen?
Yes.
Ellen?
I can hear you now.
Yes, I'm here. Okay, great.
As I said, it's going to be interesting to see who he decides to give his interviews to with as soon as he publishes the book, because he's covering this tale, and he's decided he's not getting anything from the Bushies anyway.
Yeah, indeed. What else do you see happening in Washington, D.C.?
Well, a lot going on. First of all, I just got done at the United Nations as well, and it looks like Lebanon is bubbling up a bit. And also, something very interesting that we have not heard about, as you know, next week looks like it's going to be this Annapolis conference. And it looks as if President Bush was going to attend, but now it seems, although the White House won't comment one way or the other, that if the Arab states send only in a delegation of ambassadors to the conference and not their heads of state, then the president may just send Condoleezza Rice and not go himself to Annapolis. So that's kind of interesting.
No Jimmy Carter Nobel Prize coming down the road for that kind of behavior.
No. And, I mean, he may eventually decide to show up there. Maybe he'll just open it up with a speech. But it's interesting that the White House is beginning to waffle a bit on that. Also, there have been two more members of Congress, as you know, congressman from New Jersey, is not going to be running. But also, Jerry Lewis, a Republican of California, and Ken Calvert, who's also from California, were investigated by the FBI this summer. Their investigation is still ongoing, and this has to do with earmarks and if they got essentially some sort of pay-to-play for these particular earmarks.
Right, and both of them are saying that they're not going to run for election again?
I don't know about those two, but obviously I don't think they're going to be running if they're under FBI investigation.
Yeah. They'd be high up on the list of suspects to not be around.
That's definitely not going to happen. White House today was banging away. This is the last briefing till after Thanksgiving, and it was just the morning gaggle, but banging away at the Democrats for not passing the war supplemental, and essentially saying that this was going to be, there were only 6 legislative days that they have on the books at this point. Of course, they can extend it, and they haven't done what they needed to do, and this is going to really cause the Pentagon and hurt soldiers, et cetera. So they are using this last opportunity before everybody pays attention to turkeys to bang away at the Dems.
Yeah, well, and the Dems, on the other hand, the Democrats, on the other hand, are using this last opportunity to say, no, we're not going to fund your war, are they not?
Yeah, they are.
And you're not going to get your recess appointments.
Right, they're very mindful of the fact that very, very shortly there are going to be various New Hampshire primary, et cetera. And don't forget, with the New Hampshire primary, it's very important because people don't have to, they can cross lines. In other words, if I decide I want Romney to run against Hillary Clinton, I can cross over and take a Republican ballot. And that can have a lot of implications. So they've got to make Democrats, particularly in some of those states, feel like they want to vote for a Democrat, not that they want to vote against a Democrat by putting some, you know, or help the Democratic Party by voting for a particular Republican. So
right.
New Hampshire is a very dicey primary because...
Tune in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
And welcome back to the third hour of our program. Congratulations to Bob Cameron of Arlington, Washington. Bob knew that the correct answer to our progressive pop quiz, our question for the day, former White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan in his new book says who was directly involved in and lied to him about the treasonous outing of Valerie Plame. He said the correct answer is George W. Bush. And congratulations, Bob. You're going to pick up a copy of Cracking the Code. Right now with us, speaking of books, Howard Kurtz is on the line. Howard has a new book out, Reality Show, Inside the Last Great Television News War, and author of a number of other New York Times bestsellers and major books going all the way back to Spin Cycle, Inside the Clinton Propaganda Machine back in 98. Howard Kurtz, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much.
Glad to have you with us. I'm having read much of your book, the sense that I get is that, you know, this is a dramatic and fascinating story behind the curtains, and that in a way it's meta to what our news has become. I worked in news back in the late 1970s. Well, I started in 68. I started doing news in 71. Started radio in 68. Started doing news in 71. And did it until 78 in the Lansing market, Michigan market. And we were not allowed to talk to the salespeople. Management never had anything to say in what we were programming. And since the demise of Reagan, under Reagan, of the Fairness Doctrine, and I'm not talking about the balanced part of it, I'm talking about the community service part of it, and Clinton signing the Telecommunications Act, we now have infotainment rather than news, and it's almost like your book is meta to that. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I'd be the first to say that infotainment seems to have flooded millions of outlets in the media world. But the three network even newscasts that I'm focusing on here, and I was very fortunate in being able to spend 2 years behind the scenes at these places, in the control rooms, in the studios, talking to the anchors and the executive producers and the news division presidents. I would say they're one of the last bastions of serious news. I mean, certainly I have my criticisms of some of what they do, but these are programs, and a lot of people think they're outmoded and they're dinosaurs, but these are programs that for 30 minutes a night do tackle issues of war and scandal and presidential politics and all of that. They tend not to devote much airtime at all to missing white women and Nicole Smith and Paris Hilton going to jail for an hour and a half and all that.
But, I mean, you contradict that in your own book. For example, here, you write, the central paradox of The Daily Show was that Jon Stewart regularly covered the same ground as the evening newscast, but for all his fakery, regularly managed to outclass the networks. You know, fake news is outclassing ABC, CBS, NBC. Shouldn't that be like a giant red flag that we have a problem?
Well, there are lots of problems with evening news, which I spend the book detailing. I'm simply saying that you use the phrase infotainment, and I don't think that's one of their problems. I mean, they've got a lot of problems, including the fact that, you know, the average age of their viewers is now about 95, I'm exaggerating slightly, and that their audiences, while still substantial, these newscasts still have impact, and I think had a lot of impact in the way the Iraq War was covered, they reach a substantial audience, but it's far, far smaller than that in Walter Cronkite's day. The reason I devote a chapter to Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert is not that they attempt to cover the news in any kind of serious way, but it's precisely the opposite. Because they have the leeway to satirize and make fun, not just of politics, but of the news business itself, they are sometimes able to illustrate the absurdity of politics and media coverage in a way that the staid traditional network newscast simply can't. And so now you have Charlie Gibson and Katie Couric and Brian Williams to some extent copying some of the techniques of The Daily Show, not making stuff up, at least we hope not, but using videotape to show when politicians keep repeating the same talking points over and over again, and that sort of thing. And so I believe that Jon Stewart, even though he does quote fake news, is a serious social satirist who is having an impact on the news business.
Yeah, well, I'd take it even a step beyond that and suggest that Jon Stewart will cover stories that are not covered by the mainstream news media because they consider them too hot or because they're afraid of losing access. I mean, we've got a bunch of people who are in the, and I have friends in the White House press corps. We've got a bunch of people who are in the news business now that back during Walter Cronkite's day was a job that paid the equivalent in today's dollars of probably around $50,000-$60,000 a year, maybe 70 or 80, and had good benefits and job security. And you knew that, you know, no matter what you did, pretty much as long as it was honest and had integrity, you had a job. Now, if the White House decides to blackball you, you lose your job. You're gone. And we're talking about salaries that are, you know, hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars. There's so much more at stake, and it's so much more easily manipulated. Because we've moved into this in the context of infotainment. We've also left behind the realm of real reporting, and we're into this realm of being the star.
Well, you're certainly true about the higher salaries. You're certainly right about that. I would not agree that you lose your job if the White House sours on you. In fact,
it happened to Helen Thomas.
Well, Helen Thomas didn't lose her job. Helen Thomas left UPI as the place imploded and became a columnist for Hearst. But let me talk about some things that are in the
book.
No, I
mean, she had her access cut from right at the very beginning. She asked a hard question, and Bush said, that's it. She's no longer sitting in the front row, and she's never taken a question again. They moved her to the back of the room.
Well, first of all, it's...
That would be a career killer if it happened to Mr. You know, Gregory from NBC.
It's the White House Correspondents Association, not the Bush administration, that moved Helen Thomas out of her front row seat, although I believe it was later restored. In any event, look, can the White House make life difficult by cutting off access? Absolutely. The Bush White House froze out Katie Couric for 5 years. You could not get a presidential interview or really get a time of day because the president and his people were ticked off about an interview she had done with Laura Bush just before the inauguration. In which
right,
she
and you point that out. And they
abortion.
Had to take
so
it, then they
I
had
agree
to take
with you
seriously.
On the payback part. I'm just saying I don't think you necessarily get fired from your job as a result.
But there's always the risk. Okay, here's another dimension of it. I notice on CNN, on your network, that there are ads for oil well drilling oil drilling systems. There are ads for defense contractors. I'm not going to pick up a phone and call Boeing and buy an F-14. I'm not going to call up, one of these, ConocoPhillips and order an oil drilling platform. When NPR 15, 16 years ago exposed ADM as engaging in price fixing, which led to a $300 million fine, which was the largest fine in the history of that industry at that time for that kind of crime, ADM became an advertiser on NPR, and NPR has, to the best of my knowledge, never done any more investigative reporting in that arena. Well, do you think, to what extent do you think that the advertising on your network and other networks is causing your network and other networks not to investigate the industries that are handing them millions of dollars a year, in particular the pharmaceutical industries?
None.
You don't believe that.
I'm not buying the thesis. But let me come back to your point about Jon Stewart and the impact on network news, because one example I cite in Reality Show has to do with, remember these seven clowns who were arrested, and there was a big press conference that the Bush Justice Department had because they were going to blow up the Sears Tower, and it turned out they had no equipment, no money, they'd never even been to Chicago, most of them. The network newscast, reported that as a kind of a straight traditional story. These arrests were made, here's what Alberto Gonzalez says, and so forth. And Jon Stewart, I actually happened to be behind the scenes at the Daily Show that day, came out and just, made fun of how ludicrous this was. These seven guys, they weren't even enough to field a softball team. How are they going to bring down the Sears Tower? And I think that's the kind of thing where network news, even though, Brian Williams may have hosted Saturday Night Live, but he's no Jon Stewart, even though they're never going to be as funny as a comedy show, could take the step of giving you enough analysis to show you that something, this terror plot that was hyped up by the Bush administration, was in fact a lot of hot air.
Yeah, and you tell that story actually very well in your book. We're talking with Howard Kurtz, his book Reality Show: Inside the Last Great Television News War. But why couldn't, had Jon Stewart been there, not been there, why couldn't the networks, and for that matter, why don't they just come out and call the administration on these kind of things when these happen? And the follow-up question, because we only have a minute, I'd just like to get your quick take on it, is if you don't think that those ads that I referred to are influencing NPR or CNN or et cetera, why do these people do them?
Well, I think they do them to influence the people who are watching, not necessarily to influence the news organizations.
But I'm going to buy an oil drilling rig?
That's a debate for another time. But as far as taking on the administration, I mean, there are isolated cases where it's been done. Brian Williams at NBC Nightly News, when Bush came out, made a huge deal about a four-year-old plot to blow up the the library tower in Los Angeles, basically said, boy, this sure looks like a coincidence that the White House is recycling this old story at a time when they're under attack for the domestic surveillance abuses. So there were times when anchors kind of step out of that role and do point up when somebody simply is not telling the truth or is fudging the truth, but I'd like to see it happen more often.
I was just going to say, wouldn't it be nice if it were the norm rather than the exception? Howard Kurtz's book, Reality Show, Inside the Last Great Television News War. Howard, thank you for coming on.
Good to be with you.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio, 866-303-2270. Our telephone number. We'll be right back.
Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Boy, it's talk about hardball. The Bushies are at the Republicans. I mean, this is not just Bush, but it's by and large the administration. They have now sent out a notice to 150,000 civilian workers at military bases. Now, this is, see, the way that you do it, if you want to scare the hell out of the Democrats, is you don't say to the soldiers in Iraq, gee, you may have to come home, because we can't get the funding for our ongoing occupation of Iraq. You say to the people who are working, who have jobs at the Air Force bases and Army bases and Marine Corps bases and whatnot around the United States, you may lose your job if Congress doesn't fund this thing. And all those people have families and they have good civilian jobs in the military. and many of them career jobs. My uncle Stan down near St. Louis, Missouri, for most of his life worked. There was a military base down there, and that's where he worked as a civilian. So what they're doing is they're threatening civilians. It sort of reminds me of the old Mad Magazine cover where they had the picture of the dog with a gun to its head, and the dog had this kind of look on its face, and it said, "Buy this magazine or we'll shoot the dog." That's what the Bushies are doing. They're saying they're going to issue furlough notices to 150,000 civilian workers at military bases. And John Murtha says this is as sleazy as it gets.
Once again, the president responded with more rhetoric and threats. He blamed Congress for not providing him with additional funding, but flatly refused to work with us on a solution. What he fails to mention is that he could have the money in 2 days. As Dave Obey said, he just picks up the phone and calls the Republicans in the Senate.
Yeah, indeed. All he would have to do is say, sure, I will accept the 1 year out that is attached to your funding bill. Send me the money.
While Congress is working to improve the quality of life for our troops, this administration is reversing these efforts with this political document. You talk about morale. When they make statements like we're going to lay people, there's thousands of people throughout the country that don't need to be laid off and shouldn't be laid off, and they're worrying them, those folks. This reduces the morale of the people throughout the country.
And that's exactly the point, is scare the hell out of the civilians. I mean, this is an administration that 100% works on fear. The only strategy they know is moving away from pain, and they are so good at inflicting pain or threatening pain. Jack Murtha continues.
I don't like to think this, but it's almost like a Rumsfeld-like prediction here. A Rumsfeld-like, I thought we'd gotten rid of Secretary Rumsfeld, but this really worries me that there would be such a political document. There's 7 months backlog at the depots. 7 months backlog. In other words, there's 7 months work still in the depots, fully funded. They talked about IEDs the other day. We already funded over $3 billion for IEDs in a big unobligated balance. This is a political document.
This is what he's talking about, is Bush saying, well, we're going to have to lay off 150,000 people before Christmas if we don't get unlimited funding for the occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan. And as Jack Murtha is pointing out, they've already got enough money for 7 months for funding of all of their depots. They've got all the IED stuff. There's plenty of money in the Pentagon budget to continue their war, or their occupation, they call it their war, all the way through February. Even if nothing changes, simply by the Pentagon moving money from their left hand to their right hand.
They're scaring people. They're scaring the families of the troops with this document. That's the thing that's so despicable about what they're doing.
That's exactly what they're doing, Jack Murtha, and they're doing it because they use terror against the American people. The Bush administration is using terror, fear of joblessness, fear of terrorists, for that matter. Again, we had Fran Townsend, the National Security Advisor, on her way out today saying, oh, there's an election coming up, we're going to get hit. Or, higher probability, yep, we got to watch out for that kind of thing. Come on. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Marilyn in Los Angeles. Hey, Marilyn.
Boy, Tom, I wanted to rail about Howard Kurtz because he dodged your question so obviously, and I'm glad you came back to it. But what you're talking about right now, I'm in Los Angeles, and the repercussions of the writer's strike are very parallel to what you're talking about, because there are so many little people and businesses and other people in the industry who are suffering because the powers that be don't want to negotiate fairly with the writers.
Right. So you've got the corporations basically trying to terrorize a union, and we have the Bush administration trying to terrorize Congress.
Yeah.
It's all around us. Yeah, you're absolutely right. One is meta to the other. Thank you, Marilyn. Jeff in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Jeff, about a half a minute here. Forgot to take a break.
Hey, Tom. First off, I'd just like to follow up on what that lady said about Howie Kurtz. He obviously knows.
I think he's a good guy, but he just didn't want to get into the politics of how businesses are run. And that's not what his book was about, so I understand.
Right. Yeah, I think it was a good point. I'm glad you raised it. The other thing is Cindy Sheehan has put out a call for everybody to send impeachment letters to Nancy Pelosi to
right.
her office first so she can count them up and round them up. Go to gsfp.org to learn more about it.
Okay, Gold Star Families for Peace, gsfp.org. And keeping in mind that Well, whatever. It's, yes. 27 minutes past the hour. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. In our correction department, number one, it was the National Lampoon, not Mad Magazine, that did the buy this magazine and will shoot this dog cover. Thank you to a caller. And Ben Rush, who is apparently a Presbyterian, not a theist. So, thank you to another caller. All the things we learned from our callers. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, Clifford in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Clifford.
How are you doing?
Just very well, thank you. What's up?
Well, Tom, I've been listening to you for quite a while, and I hear you extol the words and the lives of Jefferson and Madison often. And by doing so, it seems you're being very dismissive of the suffering of the African people under the rule of these Virginia slave barons. And I know you know Jefferson, and you don't, but I'm not hearing you recite his racist statements very often. And you know Thomas Jefferson may have been the most famous racist of the 19th century. And it's almost like, you know, champion Hitler if you disregard what Hitler did to the Jews. And I find that very disturbing. And I wanted to know how you reconcile championing these men knowing how abusive and racist they were.
Yeah. Well, slavery was a brutal institution, Clifford, and let me actually riff on this for a little bit. I appreciate your call and your comment, and let's go back and look at it. And where I'm going to end up with this is by and large agreeing with you. But it, as Fawn Brody wrote, who wrote probably the best biography of Thomas Jefferson, it's called Thomas Jefferson, An Intimate History, she said, it deserves notice that his phrase, all men are born free, which appeared 6 years later in the Declaration of Independence, first came to his lips publicly in the legal defense of a black man. In April of 1770, now this is, Jefferson was a young man in his 20s, he was practicing law and he defended a slave who was requesting his freedom. It was a case that was called Howell versus Netherland. And in his arguments on behalf of that slave, Jefferson said, quote, under the law of nature, all men are born free, and everyone comes into the world with the right to his own person, which includes the liberty of moving and using it at his own will. The year before, in 1769, he had been elected to the legislature of Virginia. His first piece of legislation was to eliminate primogeniture, which is the passing on of property to the eldest son, including property, including slaves, and to abolish the importation of slaves into Virginia. First piece of legislation that he submitted. It didn't work. It was unsuccessful. And in fact, it so angered the other legislators in Virginia that they passed two laws that made it nearly impossible for anybody in Virginia to free their slaves. One said this was a law of Virginia law that was passed as, in part as a consequence of Jefferson trying to ban slavery in Virginia, that said that slaves who are freed and stay in the state may be, I'm quoting from the law now, hung, burned at the stake. This is after they've been freed. May be hung, burned at the stake, dismembered, castrated, and branded, as well as the ordinary punishment of whipping. End quote. There was also a law that was passed in Virginia that said that any white man who was determined to have fathered children by a slave, those children would be given to church wardens of the parish for 2 years of hard Christian labor and then sold into the general slavery market and could not be bought by that person or any member of his family. Again, this was in response to some of the rumors of Jefferson and Sally Hemings, I'm assuming, given the timing on this thing. But this is a guy who actually spent much of his life arguing against slavery. Granted, and again, hang on with this thought, granted he was a slaveholder. In 1774, he wrote a book called A Summary View of the Rights of British Americans, attacking George III for forcing slavery on the colonies. He repeated this in the first draft of the Declaration of Independence in 1776, but they had to delete it from the final draft of the Declaration in order to get South Carolina and Georgia to sign the document. He again introduced provisions as a legislator in the state of Virginia, one to amend the Constitution of the state of Virginia in 1777 that would eliminate slavery altogether in that state by the year 1800. And in 1778, he presented an even more radical bill that would have abolished slavery altogether, not only in Virginia, but in all surrounding states. No commerce with states that are practicing slavery. In 1783, he again unsuccessfully attempted to amend Virginia's Constitution, proposing language that said, quote, "The General Assembly shall not permit the introduction of any more slaves to reside in the state or the continuance of the institution of slavery beyond the generation which shall be living on the 31st day of December, 1800. All persons born after that day hereby being declared free." He lost. The next year, he proposed at the national level, now he's a national legislator, a law banning slavery in the Northwest Territories, the Midwest and the Western states. That proposal lost by a single vote in the legislature. In 1820, now here we are, Jefferson was president from 1800 to 1808. Or 1801 to 1809. And so in 1820, Missouri and Maine were being admitted as states into the Union. And Jefferson had authored the legislation saying that Missouri could not be a slave state, as he was trying to eliminate slavery across the United States. Maine was already a free state. It was not a slave state. John Holmes of Massachusetts wrote a letter to the elderly Thomas Jefferson. At this time, this is 6 years before he died. Jefferson is writing with a quill pen, his hands cramped by arthritis. And John Holmes sends him a letter saying they're going to do the Missouri Compromise. They're going to allow slavery in Missouri if they also allow Maine to become a state. Jefferson wrote back to Holmes this letter. He said, "I thank you, dear sir, for the copy you've been so kind to send me of the letter to your constituents on the Missouri problem. It is a perfect justification to them. I had for a long time ceased to read newspapers or pay any attention to public affairs, confident they are in good hands and content to be a passenger in our bark, our canoe, to the shore from which I am not distant." In other words, he's like, hey, you know, I haven't been reading the newspapers. I'm going to die soon. But then Jefferson in his letter, Jefferson continues the letter. The elderly Thomas Jefferson, he said, "But this momentous question, like a fire bell in the night, awakened and filled me with terror. I consider it at once the death knell of the Union. It is hushed indeed for the moment, but this is a reprieve only, not a final sentence. A geographical line," here he is talking about the Mason-Dixon line, "a geographical line coincided with a marked principle," that, of course, being slavery, "moral and political, once conceived and held up to the angry passions of men, will never be obliterated, and every new irritation will mark it deeper and deeper. I can say with conscious truth that there is not a man on earth who would sacrifice more than I would to relieve us from this heavy reproach in any practicable way. The cessation of that kind of property," that would be slaves, "for so it is misnamed, is a bagatelle." This is a phrase for a small issue. "Which would not cause me a second thought if in any way a general emancipation and extirpation of slavery could be effected. And gradually and with due sacrifices, I think it might be." And then he continues in this letter, you get the tears in his eyes. I mean, as he's discussed, one more slave state, he thought, I mean, when they wrote the Constitution, you read the Constitution, it actually, the people, when it was ratified, they believed that the Constitution ended slavery in the year 1800, and it didn't happen. He said, he continues his letter, he says, "I regret that I am now to die in the belief that the useless sacrifice of themselves by the generation of 1776 to acquire self-government and happiness to their country is to be thrown away by the unwise and unworthy passions of their sons, and that my only consolation is to be that I will not live to weep over it. If they would but dispassionately weigh the blessings they will throw away against an abstract principle of slavery more likely to be affected by union than by scission, they would pause before they perpetrate this act of suicide on themselves and of treason against the hopes of the world." These guys who thought they could end slavery in 1800, and Jefferson was at the lead of that, were wrong. And as a result of their failure, 620,000 Americans died in the Civil War. And it is very easy for us in this day and age to look back 200 years and criticize Jefferson. The truth is he used cheap labor, the resource of his slaves, free labor, to, well, cheap. You have to feed people, but nonetheless, to maintain his lifestyle. And the consequence of the failure of his efforts to abolish slavery was a bloody civil war followed by 100 years of legal apartheid that in many regards continues to this day. Although he rationalized his slaveholding by keeping them in a style that exceeded that of most poor whites of the day, both were grim by today's standards, it is nonetheless a rationalization of slavery. Jefferson's lifestyle was made possible by slave labor. There's no other way to say it. Recognizing that fact, many of us are righteously indignant and quick to judge him harshly. Yet how many of us, and this is the question I ask of you, how many of us are willing to free our slaves? The computer in front of me was made in China. The pants I'm wearing are Levi's. The last time Levi's were made in the United States was about 4 years ago. The shirt I'm wearing was made in Malaysia. As I look around me, I'll bet 70-80% of the stuff around that I'm looking at, and probably the stuff that you're looking at, was made by slaves or people who are living in near slavery. The reality, the stark reality, is that we in America did not end slavery. We merely exported it. And it's so much more comfortable for us to criticize Jefferson for agonizing over, but still using slave labor 200 years ago, when we don't have to look into the faces of today's slaves who are toiling and dying at this very moment to sustain our lifestyles. 45 minutes past the hour.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
It's a Vietnam vet with a cardboard sign, sitting there by the left turn line. Flag on the wheelchair flapping in the breeze, one leg missing and both hands free. No one's paying much mind to him. The VA budget's just stretched so thin, and there's more coming back from the Mideast war. We can't make it here anymore. And that big old building was a textile mill. It fed our kids and it paid our bills, but they turned us out and they closed the doors. We can't make it here anymore. See those pallets piled up on the loading dock? They're just gonna sit there till they rot, 'cause there's nothing to ship, nothing to pack, just busted concrete and rusted tracks. Empty storefronts around the squares, a needle in the gutter and glass everywhere. You don't come down here unless you're looking to score. We can't make it here anymore.
Are we all becoming the slaves of the multinationals? Might that be another way to frame this? Obviously, I am not justifying slavery 250 years ago any more than I'm justifying it today. I'm condemning both. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Pat in Redwood City, California. Hey, Pat, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I meant to call on another topic, but I just want to insert one thing, which is I was in a class in college where we were required to read Jefferson's book, Notes on the State of Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just too bad that he was so conflicted about slavery.
Yeah.
I'll just leave it at that and move to my question. If memory serves, a couple years back, Bush and the Democrats agreed to a ceasefire, so to speak, regarding recess appointments. Wondering what came of that, if it was only about judges or if it was for any sorts of recess appointments.
Recess appointments are for any of the positions that the executive can appoint, frankly. And recess appointment clause in the Constitution, which was really designed for times of emergency when Congress wasn't in session and it would take 3 days for somebody on a horse to get back to Washington, D.C., gave the executive the ability to appoint pretty much anybody to any position that they would normally, you know, be appointable to with the authorization of the Senate.
That much I understand, but I thought they had Bush and the Democrats had agreed that Bush wouldn't make any more recess appointments.
That was during the last recess. And that was apparently the deal that was cut. It was never publicly stated, but he did not make any appointments, and the Democrats did go on vacation. And apparently the deal was that they would give him his six-month FISA bill if he would not make any recess appointments. And they gave him the bill, and he didn't make any recess appointments. This time it looks like there's been no compromise, and Harry Reid is calling Congress back, you know, every 3 days, I think it is, or something like that. They're going to have a pro forma, which means in form only. You know, one person steps up and says a few words, and Congress doesn't actually conduct any business, but it is not out of session. So that's what's happening, Pat. Thanks for the call. 866-303-2270, our number, Gene in Orange County, California. Hey, Gene.
Hi, I'm calling about the issue of separation of church and state.
Mm-hmm, back to our first hour.
I know, but I'm...
No, it's okay. I'm just for our listeners who might have just tuned in. I'm just...
No, I was watching C-SPAN the other morning, flicking back and forth between the House and the Senate, and they had a Christian minister in one of them, I'm not sure which house it was in, giving the prayer before they started. And I thought his prayer was more of a political speech. He was telling the Lord what he wanted him to do, you know, saying the people that think this, help them to. And it to me looked like religion was really crossing into politics way too much.
Yeah, I don't disagree, Gene, and thanks for pointing that out. In fact, Madison argued very strongly that if Congress was going to have a minister, and if sessions of Congress are going to be opened with a prayer, that the members of Congress themselves, out of their own pockets, should pool their money to pay the salary of that person rather than having the government pay it. And he was essentially voted down in that. But as a member of the House of Representatives, a member of Congress, he introduced legislation to that effect, which did not pass, did not succeed. So, you know, which was a testimony to how strong the clergy was back then. But I keep thinking back to the Sermon on the Mount. You know, these Christians who are standing up and speaking and praying in public, you know, where Jesus said quite explicitly, you can go read it, I think it's in Matthew 5 or maybe it's chapter 6, but, you know, don't pray in public. That's what the hypocrites do. You know, when you pray, go into your closet, close the door and pray in secret to the Father who hears you in secret, and you will be, you know, rewarded. But, you know, if you pray in public, and in fact, throughout his time on earth, the only one time that Jesus actually prayed in public was in the Garden of Gethsemane before he was crucified. And he opens the prayer. It's fascinating to go back and read it. He opens the prayer by saying, Father, I know that you hear me when I talk to you in private. And the only reason that I'm telling you this in front of these witnesses is so that they will be encouraged. In other words, he's saying that, you know, he's doing a public prayer, not to God, but to the people around him. It's a speech. I just thought that was fascinating. And anyway, Steve in Venetia, California. Hey, Steve.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I just had a comment regarding the ultra-right conservative Christian evangelical movement. One of the deepest, darkest secrets of this group is that they don't believe in democracy. In fact, they're amongst themselves, they're quite open about it. But
yeah, they believe in theocracy. And theocracywatch.org is one of the best sites for information on this.
Well, yeah, but their point being is that democracy was invented by the ancient Greeks who were pagans.
Right.
So anybody following the democracy is basically a pagan or, you know, a pagan follower and believer. So they like a lot of other jihadists and just don't believe in democracy.
Yeah, bottom line. Well said, Steve. Thank you very much. Coming up tomorrow, the FCC chief says he wants to relax the media ownership ban. Eli Lehrer will be here saying big media is no threat to our free society. In Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, Kenneth Swain is here on World Hunger, the roller coaster ride through the pros and cons of the genetically modified food debate, plus the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People, reminding you, don't forget, activism begins with you. Democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.